Our Haftorah portion comes from Joshua chapter 2, which is the account of Joshua sending the two spies into Canaan to spy out Jericho. The reason this Haftorah portion was chosen to go with our Torah portion from Numbers is because the book of Numbers is the account of the 12 spies going into Canaan. They spend 40 days there looking at the entire land of Canaan. And as you well know the story, when they returned, 10 of the spies gave it a thumbs down. They said, we just can't take the country. The country is a country that consumes its people. The people there are giants. We appeared as grasshoppers, our own eyes. That was true. It flows with milk and honey and got these huge grapes, but we just can't take it. And, of course, Joshua and Caleb, they speak up and say, we can take it. Don't do this. Let's go. God has delivered them into our hand. But the entrance into Canaan was delayed for 40 years because of the unfaithfulness of that generation. So here in Joshua 2, we're 40 years later. And this time, Joshua sends two spies in, not 12, just two, and not to explore the whole country, but just to go to Jericho. So, let's just read the story. Joshua, son of Nun, dispatched two men, spies, from Shittim, secretly saying, go observe the land and Jericho. So they went and arrived at the house of a woman. Now, your translation may say innkeeper, but that's being very polite. The Hebrew word there is zona. She was a harlot. She may have had an inn, but she was a harlot, whose name was Rahab, and slept there. It was told to the king of Jericho, saying, behold, men have come here this night from the children of Israel to spy out the land. The king of Jericho sent to Rahab, saying, bring out the men who have come to you, who have come to your house, for they have come to spy out the entire land. The woman had taken the two men and hidden them. She said, it is true, the men did come to me, but I do not know from where they are. When the city gate was about to close at dark, the men went out. I do not know where the men went. Pursue them quickly, for you can overtake them. Now, she's lying, right? Her words are deceptive. But if you break down each sentence, you'll find that technically everything she said was true. It is true, the men did come to me. I do not know from where they are. True enough. When the city gate was about to close at dark, the men went out. It's true. They went out and up under the roof. Didn't say they went out the gate. It just says, when the gate closed, they went out. I do not know where the men went. Now, that's kind of tough. She knew generally they're up on the roof. Exactly where on the roof, I'm not quite sure. Okay? But, that probably could classify as a lie. Pursue them quickly, for you can't overtake them. Yeah, they go on the roof. Now, the question is, did she really lie? You know, technically maybe not, but then again, yes, she did. Is this wrong? According to the sages, you can break any commandment to save a life, except for three. You do not murder to save a life. Now, that doesn't mean self-defense. Self-defense is allowed, but murder is not. Fornication or adultery is not allowed. You die before you commit that sin. And the third is idolatry. Those three, you never compromise on. But if it comes to saving a life, you'll find many men in the Bible, godly men, did twist the truth in order to save a life. In other words, it's okay to deceive a deceiver. To deceive an enemy of the truth, if it saves a life. But you do not murder to save a life. You do not commit idolatry. You do not commit adultery or fornication. Now, that's what the sages say. You can agree with them or disagree with them. But it is interesting the number of times you find in Scripture where the truth was twisted to one who's an enemy of the truth in order to save a life, and God never rebuked the person for doing it. It's kind of an interesting study. So I'm not making any claims here that this is what we need to do or how we should do it. I'm just saying that this is what happens here and other places in Scripture. We never see Rahab rebuked for this. In fact, she's found in the Hall of Faith in Hebrews. She's held up as an example of great faithfulness because of how she protected the lives of these two spies. She also became an ancestor of Messiah. She's the mother of Boaz, who is, I believe, the great-grandfather of David. So just something to think about. And don't ask me any questions about it today, all right? Verse 6, but she had brought them up to the roof and hidden them in the stalks of flax that had been arranged for her on the roof. So the men pursued them in the direction of the Jordan to the crossings, and they closed the gate soon after the pursuers had gone out after them. They had not yet gone to sleep, but she came up to them on the roof. She said to the men, I know that the Lord has given you the land, and that fear of you has fallen upon us, and all the inhabitants of the land have dissolved because of you. For we have heard, A, how the Lord dried up the waters of the Sea of Reeds for you when you went forth out of Egypt, and B, what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were across the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. We heard, and our hearts melted. No spirit remained in any man because of you. For the Lord, your God, he is God in the heavens above and on the earth below. Now I beseech you, swear to me by the Lord, since I have done kindness with you, that you too will do kindness with my father's household and give me a trustworthy sign, that you will keep alive my father, my mother, my brothers, and my sisters, and all that is theirs, and that you will save our souls from death. This is a tremendous act of faith, isn't it? You know, as I was reading this, I'm thinking, here's a woman, based only on what she has heard, and what does faith come by? Hearing. Based on what she had heard, she chose to put her confidence not in the walls of Jericho, not in the status quo, not in business as usual, not in all the fortifications of this city, but instead to put her faith in what she had heard about the God of Israel. Instead of having faith in the seen, she chose to put her faith in the unseen. And she did it at the risk of her own life. Because if they discover that she has protected these Israelites, these spies, she's dead. But she also realizes that if the God of Israel is everything that she's heard him to be, and she doesn't put her faith in him, she's dead. One way or the other, she's going to die. So who does she put her faith in? Who is it she cast her lot with? That's the situation every one of us is in. You can put your faith in the scene, the status quo, the fortifications of this world, or you can put your faith in the unseen. You can have faith in what you have heard about our Messiah, about the God of Israel. There's your choice. And it's a life and death situation. So you better be very careful which one you place your faith in. We're going to come back and revisit this. But in verse 14, the men said to her, I have to stop at another moment here. I can't help but think back to 40 years earlier. That generation had seen signs. Otot is the word in Hebrew. They'd seen the otot of God, the signs he did in Egypt, the plagues he brought against all the gods of Egypt, the parting of the Red Sea, the provision of the manna, the giving of the Torah on Sinai, the water from the rock. They'd seen all these things, and yet they didn't have the faith to go in and take Canaan. But here's a woman who hasn't seen any of this, but places her faith in the God of Israel, and she asks the men for a sign. And what is the sign that they give her? They give her two. Verse 14, then the men said to her, our souls will die instead of yours if you do not relate this discussion of ours, and it will be when the Lord gives us the land that we will do kindness and truth with you. She lowered them by the rope through the window, for her house was in a wall of the fortification, and she lived in the fortification. She said to them, go to the mountain. In other words, instead of going back east across the Jordan, go west up to the mountain. If you ever go to Jericho, Jericho is the largest oasis in the world. It's right on the Jordan River, and if you look to the east, it's fairly flat, some rolling hills. But if you look west, it's just a huge cliff. It goes way, way, way up. And then there's a road, that's the Jericho Road, that goes up to Jerusalem. But there's this huge cliff with a plateau up there. And that is what's considered to be the Mount of Temptation. That's where Yeshua is tempted. And possibly when Yeshua is up there and Satan tempted him, he's looking down at Jericho as an example of the kingdoms of the world. So it's interesting to think he tells them to head west, go up to the mountain, because they're going to be looking for you to the east. And so that's exactly what they did. They went west. Go to the mountain, lest the pursuers encounter you. Conceal yourselves there for 3 days until the pursuers turn back. Then you may continue on your way. The men said to her, "We are absolved from this oath of yours, which you made us swear." So there's the first sign. They swore an oath to her. "Behold, when we come into the land, you shall tie this cord of scarlet thread in the window through which you lowered us, and your father and your mother and your brothers and your father's entire household you shall bring into you into the house. Then it shall be that anyone who leaves the doors of your house or the outside, his blood will be on his head, and we will be absolved. But regarding anyone who will be with you inside the house, his blood will be on our head, if a hand will be laid upon him." So there are the signs. They made an oath to her, and there she was to put the cord of scarlet thread in her window as a sign. "But if you relate this discussion of ours, we will be absolved of our oath that you have made us swear." She said, "As you say, so it is." She sent them forth, and they went, and she tied the cord of scarlet thread in the window. They went and arrived at the mountain and stayed there 3 days until the pursuers turned back. The pursuers searched along the entire way, but they did not find them. The two men then returned and descended from the mountain. They crossed the Jordan and came to Joshua, son of Nun, and told him all that had happened to them. They said to Joshua, "The Lord has given the land into our hands, and all the inhabitants of the land have even melted because of us." So Joshua is getting ready to go into Canaan. Now, is this his first visit to Canaan or his second? The second. He'd been there once, 40 years earlier, for a period of 40 days. And now he's getting ready to go back. Let's do a little review. Let's think back to the book of Numbers, to Joshua's first entrance into the land of Canaan. And you remember there he was sent by Moses. God instructed Moses, and he was sent by God's command through the mouth of Moses. What was Israel like at that time? It was a faithless generation. And that whole generation had to die in the wilderness, and their children had to grow up and take their place. And the stunning thing about this is the reason they did not want to go into Canaan was to protect their children. They were afraid their children would die there. And it turns out, stayed in the wilderness, the old generation died, the children grew up, and the children went in and lived. Remember how we talked about last week or a week before, do not let fear be part of the formula when you make decisions. We see, though, out of the 12 spies, two are faithful, Joshua and Caleb, a Jew and a Gentile. People often are stunned when they discover Caleb was not Jewish. He was a Gentile convert who had attached himself to the tribe of Judah. But he was a Gentile. And the scriptures tell us there in Numbers, I think chapter 15, if I'm not mistaken, that Caleb had a different spirit. He had a different spirit. So here we have Joshua, and we have Caleb, who had a different spirit. It's in chapter Numbers 14, verse 24. So we see out of that, out of those 12 spies, out of that entire older generation, there was a remnant that was faithful. Joshua and Caleb were threatened when they said, "We can go take the land. Let's go. We can do this. The kingdom's right here. Let's cross over and take it. God's delivered it into our hands. Now's the time. This is the place. Let's do it according to the word of the Lord. Let's go." And they were threatened. In fact, the commentators state, the Kopetz Chaim says this, remember right before Moses sent Joshua the spies into Canaan, he blessed Joshua. He prayed over Joshua and blessed him and changed his name from Hosea to Yehoshua, to Yeshua. The Kofetz Chaim comments on this and says, Moses knew that Joshua would speak up and oppose the spies, and thus put him in danger that they might not harm him. Therefore, Moses prayed for him. It's the Kofetz Chaim is saying he realized Joshua's life was at stake, and they would try to kill him, so he prayed for him. Because of their faithlessness, entrance into the land was delayed. But intercession is made for the people. But then, after they found out it was delayed, what did they do? They decided, oh, oops, we were wrong, let's go take it. And Moses says, too late. Don't try, you're going to fail. They went in and tried and just got bloodied up. They got beat up. So Israel makes a futile attempt to conquer Canaan. What does all this sound like? What does this remind us of as we read about this first entrance, this first visit to Canaan? It reminds us of Yeshua's first visit to earth. He was sent. He came to a faithless generation. There was a believing remnant of Jew and Gentile, a few, but because the majority of the leaders were against the kingdom coming right then, even though they were right on the doorstep, the kingdom of God is here. Because of their faithlessness, because of their hatred of Joshua and Caleb and their message, the entrance was delayed. But they did embrace some false messiahs, Bar Kokhba and a few others. They did try to overthrow the Roman Empire on their own and failed miserably at it. So there's a delay. Whenever you see a period of time that is 40 days, 40 years, 40 whatever, it's always a picture of this. I don't like using the word dispensation. It has some real negative connotations. But this period of time between Yeshua's first visit and his return. So it's just a little insight there, a little code word. When you see something that's 40 days long or 40 years long, it refers to this period of time between Messiah's first and second coming. Now, the second time, Joshua's not coming to visit. He's coming to stay. Isn't that true? Once Joshua came the second time to Canaan, he stayed there, lived there, and that's where he was from then on. He came to a faithful generation. And he found that during, this is the amazing thing, that during the 40 years, God was at work among the Gentiles. During the 40 years, God was at work in the life of Rahab and her family. Go back to her words for a moment. Go back to Joshua 2, verse 10. And what does Rahab say? For we have heard how the Lord dried up the waters of the Sea of Reeds. That was 40 years earlier. That was when Israel first came out of Egypt. That was 40-year-old news. And the second thing, what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were across the Jordan, that was more recent news. This is a wonderful thing. Get a picture of this. Israel had failed, but Israel's God was still moving in the hearts of Gentiles who hadn't seen him, who hadn't seen Israel. They had not seen the events talked about here, but they had heard, and faith comes by hearing. And isn't this true, that even though the kingdom 2,000 years ago was here, it was right on the doorstep, all Israel had to do was step in, and the kingdom of God would have come 2,000 years ago. So because of faithlessness, it was delayed. The Jewish generation, that generation failed, but the God of Israel did not. And during that time of Israel's failure, Gentiles have still been embracing Israel's God. Isn't that amazing? Think about that. Now, Paul talks about this, and I can't help but think that he was thinking about this chapter we're looking at when he wrote these words. But if you go to Romans for a moment, go to Romans chapter 2. No, we'll come back to chapter 2. Go to Romans chapter 9. Chapter 11. Pick a number between 1 and 25. Romans 11. Romans 11. Verse 11. Paul in this chapter is talking about God's program with the Jewish people and with the Gentiles and how things fit together. It's a wonderful, wonderful chapter. I know many of you have studied it in great detail. But in Romans 11:11, Paul says, I say then, they, Israel, the Jews, did not stumble so as to fall, did they? May it never be. But by their transgression, salvation has come to the Gentiles to make them jealous. Think for a moment. If 40 years earlier, Israel had come into Canaan, attacked Jericho, and conquered it and destroyed it, what would have happened to Rahab and her family? They were dead. They were gone. But because of Israel's failure, because of their faithlessness, salvation comes to the home of Rahab. But by their transgression, salvation has come to the Gentiles. And then you go on down to verse 15. For if their rejection is the reconciliation of the world, what will their acceptance be but life from the dead? So here, 40 years later, when Israel's coming into Jericho, there's Rahab, her father, his house, her house, the sisters, brothers, the whole family, waiting, waiting for them to be rescued from Jericho. It was not just a mission of destruction of Jericho, but of rescue also of the believers who were there. You get a picture? Amazing picture. Yes, Robin. Absolutely not. Not replacement theology, delay theology. That God simply delayed the program. He knew it, of course, the end from the beginning. But no, not replacement at all. In fact, this is the next thing I want to bring up. In Deuteronomy, Moses, which comes right before Joshua, when Moses is preparing to die, he addresses the Jewish people, and he commands them very distinctly, when you go to Canaan and you go to Jericho, you destroy every soul there. Do not leave one of them remaining in Jericho. Not a single one. None of them. Zero, zip, zilch, nada. None of them. They all die. Well, wait a minute. Was it wrong then to let Rahab and her whole family live? You know what the sages say? The sages say that the moment Rahab put her faith in the God of Israel, she became a Jew. She became an Israelite. She's no longer a Canaanite. And when her family embraced the truth of what they'd heard about the God of Israel, they were now Jews. No conversion process necessary at all. So she was not replacing Israel. She was grafted into Israel. So then the destruction of Jericho and the Canaanites no longer applied to her. Isn't that an amazing thing? Incredible thing. So during the 40 years when Israel's wandering around the wilderness and they're thinking, oh, we failed, we goofed up, think of the how much they must have regretted their failure to come into the kingdom then. Remember what Paul says. Their falling away is salvation for the Gentiles. God's still at work. And so when they come in, it's a reuniting. It's a reuniting of those who've been grafted into Israel with those who are born into Israel. And also judgment then to the unbelieving Gentiles. Okay, I saw a hand up over here. Valerie, yes?
Hey, back in Romans, verse 15, it says, for if their rejection, what is he rejecting? What is he saying that they're rejecting?
They rejected the kingdom, the offer of the kingdom at that time. Messiah had come. Messiah had come. He said, the kingdom of God's here. But the leaders, remember, it wasn't even the vast majority of the Jewish people, it was the leaders. That's why leadership is such an important burden to bear. Because in God's economy, what the leaders decide has a powerful influence and a powerful effect upon those who follow those leaders. This is whether it's a father of a family, or whether it's an elder of a fellowship, or a president or a king of a country. That leader will determine to a great degree the fate of those under him or her. So we can't lose sight of that. And so because a handful of Jewish leaders were faithless at the times of Yeshua, it affected the entire people of Israel. The entire people. But there was a bigger purpose. Because God wanted the Rahabs of the world to receive salvation. That's why he says, if they're falling away as riches and salvation to Gentiles, how much more will it be when they return? And later, I think it's in this chapter, to go to the end of chapter 11 of Romans. Verse 30, we'll pick it up there. For just as you once were disobedient to God, but now have been shown mercy because of their disobedience, he's talking to the Romans, the Gentiles, for just as you once were disobedient to God, but now have been shown mercy because of their disobedience, so these also now have been disobedient, that because of the mercy shown to you, they also may now be shown mercy. For God has shut up all, Jew and Gentile, in disobedience, so that he may show mercy to all. Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable are his judgments, and unfathomable his ways. What Paul's saying, no man could have thought this plan up. No man could have written this script. Only God could. And it's working. For who has known the mind of the Lord, or who became his counselor? Or who is first given to him that it might be paid back to him again? For from him and through him and to him are all things. To him be the glory forever. Amen. Like I always say, with this kind of God, you can't lose. You just can't lose. Yes, Jim, you've been patient back there.
Would it be valid to say that though there was a quotation mark around the failure of Israel, God still has his eye on his original plan, mm-hmm. of course, to, though it's in terms going to the Gentiles, when Gentiles do come to the Messiah, mm-hmm. they really aren't any longer Gentiles. They are Jewish. So in reality, he gets what he wanted to start with.
Exactly. It all comes out perfectly in the end. There's no comparison. No, mea kamoka, Adonai. Who's like you, O Lord? There's no one to compare to him, because he can take what to us is an absolute total disaster. He turns it into poetry. I mean, look at the crucifixion. There it is. A disaster one day is poetry 3 days later. It's a victory. Only God gets away with that. I should say, that's not the right term. Only God can accomplish that. Only he can. And to address your question, go back to Romans chapter 2. That's the verse I started to look at. Because this goes back to Rahab. Jim was asking about being Jewish. You know, your DNA may not be Jewish as a physical descendant of Abraham, but your spiritual DNA can be. And that's really who you are. This is just your earth suit, and you change this later on. Because at the end of chapter 2, Romans chapter 2, the last two verses, start with verse 28, for he is not a Jew who is the one outwardly, nor is circumcision that which is outward in the flesh, but he is a Jew who is one inwardly, and circumcision is that which is of the heart, by the Spirit, not by the letter. And his praise is not from men, but from God. That applies to Rahab and applies to us. Isn't it amazing? I'm so glad that God picked a harlot rather than a blacksmith or a you know, a realtor or a lawyer or a doctor or whatever. He picked a harlot. The very dregs of society. To show this is how his grace reaches. It doesn't make any difference who you are. It doesn't matter who you put your faith in. Which one? Putting the faith in the walls of Jericho or in the God of Israel? Which one? Yeah, Carla.
What is that, the fact that it has to do with the idolatry, you know, of the many gods and worshiping other gods? I did a study on Rahab a couple of years ago, and I assumed no one was sufficient to shoot, you know, that she's
wealthy. Probably so.
They weren't poor at all, and the reports that she heard about what had happened to Jews were from the top guys.
Yeah.
The other beyond any influence.
That's very possible. I know that's what tradition teaches. And that even makes it more amazing in a lot of ways that she would put her faith in God of Israel. Because she had so much to lose if she's wrong.
Well, she was innocent. She was a new people. And they say, she was the people of God.
Yes. That's great. Yeah. Yes, it's reliable.
Yeah.
And you know, you bring up a big point too. I was thinking about this week. Because I was thinking, she had not yet met the God of Israel. She hadn't met Joshua. She hadn't seen any of these things. So what was it she was embracing? She was embracing a message, and that was good enough. You know, as a kid, I always heard the term, you must receive Jesus into your heart. And as a child, you think in very concrete terms. Okay, how does he get in there? Will he fit? What do I feed him? You know, I mean, you have these concrete terms that never made sense to me. Later on, I began to realize this is figurative language, but it's still language. It's not really scriptural language. And what we really receive is the engrafted word, which is able to save our souls, it says in James 1. Because, you know, I haven't seen Jesus. I will someday. But I'm told it's more blessed to believe and not have seen than to have seen and believe. I haven't seen him. I have not seen God face to face, though I'm told and commanded to seek his face. I've experienced his reality in intangible kinds of ways. I've seen prayers answered. But basically, what I have embraced is a message that comes to me through his word. And by embracing that message, God says, that's embracing me. And the way you totally embrace that message is not really by just praying a prayer, though that is something that will follow, or even by baptism, though that's something that should follow, or Bible study, or being a participant in a community of believers. The way you embrace this fully, once you decide this is the truth, I accept it in my life, the way you embrace it is by obeying it. Begin to obey his words. You're not saved by works, but you're saved by grace through faith, and that better be a faith that works. I think too many times we've tried to make things easy for people by saying, just pray this prayer, or just go up the aisle, or just sign this card, or just join this class. And by trying to make it easier, we actually complicate things. Although all of those are good things, I'm not against them. The way we embrace God is with our whole bodies obeying his word. And we start somewhere, doing something. It's not the works that save us, but those works are proof that our faith wants to embrace the message of God. You understand me? Anymore when I witness to people, when I share the truth of Messiah with them, I don't get them to pray a prayer. I simply try to get them to start living according to the word of God. Do you really want to make Yeshua boss in your life? Well, let's look at some things he says to do. Let's start doing those. Let's start changing our lives now and doing things his way instead of yours. And that's a lot more effective. That's a lot more effective than saying, say this prayer, and now I keep my fingers crossed hoping they don't renege. You know? There's nothing to renege on. You start living that life or you don't live that life. Yes, sir. You are what you read. That's a good way to put it.
I mean, just like physically, you know,
yeah.
You know, whatever we consume, you know, helps us develop who we are.
Yes. Absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
Absorb a life message or something where it's
mm-hmm.
Yes, you're saved or whatever, you know. absorb and do this. I mean,
you
can't,
right.
you can't be expected to change the earth.
Right.
So, you know, it makes sense for the sex to mm-hmm. work in the land and just live, and that's really is change.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
There's so many people that lose their faith because they don't understand what it really is, you know, before and after it is. But without it, you're in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like you're eating candy and it tastes great, but it certainly doesn't go anywhere long.
I think, as you're talking, you're reminding me of something, too. What you're saying is so true. We need to start having boom mics so I can stick on sticks so people can pick up the voices on the tape. I think one of the errors that is unintentional that's made is that we demand great faith from people who are coming to the Lord because our estimation of God's grace is small. Whereas, the other way around, you're saved by grace. This is huge. Through faith. And how big is the faith that God requires? Oh, grain of mustard seed, eye of a needle, that's plenty. That's all the faith you need. That's all the faith you need. God only requires the slightest bit of faith, because His grace is more than sufficient. Because, let's go a step further. Okay, Rahab has made this covenant with these two spies. Let's talk about Rahab's family. She talked to the spies. Her family, all they talked to was Rahab. Yet, they had enough faith in what Rahab was saying. Listen, when the city comes under attack, just come to my place. Come to my room up here in the wall. Just come here. I don't want to go on the wall. That's where they're going to be throwing rocks at us and shooting things through the window. No, just come in here. Just be in here and you'll be safe. I mean, all they had to do is to almost have faith in her faith, which is kind of odd. It reminds me of the jail keeper. And Paul says, you know, you place your faith in the Lord, Yeshua, you'll be saved and your household. It's almost like there's this I don't know how to put it, and I feel like I'm getting out on the end of a limb here, and somebody's going to ask a question that cuts me right off on the ground. But you get what I'm getting at. It's not that God requires great belief to get started down this road. It's just a tiny bit of faith because His grace is so mammoth. But just something, an indication, and then He'll take it from there. Yeah. Kim, your hand is up first.
Maybe I'm seeing this wrong, but I can see for 40 years that she saw the, for lack of better words, the corruption of society or the smut of the earth.
She must have gotten disillusioned with Jericho.
How many mayors or chief council people did she run? She run through her place, and this one's backstabbing that one, that one's backstabbing that one. And it's easy after 40 years of seeing what's really happening to believe what God can do and have faith. And it took a while for that, but maybe I'm seeing it, but if I can just take
today's society, and
pretend it doesn't change that much, that's what she saw. It's like, well, this guy's saving the world.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to follow that and forget
tomorrow. Yeah. Well, you bring up a good point. I think there is such a thing as a healthy dose of disillusionment with the world. Yeah. I think as young people, we get very illusioned with the world, and then we get disillusioned. And once we do that, we're ready to start doing business with God. Yeah, so I'm sure that's true with Rahab. It had to have been, I think. That's a good point. Yeah. Or she's desperate enough to say, you know what? If it turns out the Israelites lose and I get killed, I'm ready to go. But I'm ready to cast my lot on this chance at what they say is true, that God is who I've heard He is. Boy, that's amazing. That's amazing. Desperation. No, God doesn't, we don't find God at the middle of our rope. We find God at the end. That's where He's waiting for us. Now, Jim, you had your hand up. Oh, okay. That gives me time to think of an answer. Okay.
I'm thinking of it being like this. It becomes your responsibility to throw out that small little mustard seed of faith, but as soon as that's done, then it's completely God's responsibility.
Oh, yeah.
To answer that.
He rushes in. He rushes in, yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. this brings up a lot of things. I'm going to stay on course here. I have a bunny trail I'd love to take, but we'll just save that for Beit Midrash. Well, let's move on here a bit. We saw this overhead here. We see that when Joshua came to Canaan the second time, it wasn't to visit, it was to stay. Israel was a faithful generation. We see Rahab, this believing remnant of the Gentiles. And of course, Caleb, I should have put Caleb here. Caleb's still with Joshua. He's preceded by two witnesses. And when we read in Revelation, we find that right before the Lord's return, he sends two witnesses. You can read all about it in Revelation. And those witnesses witness for how long? In the streets of Jerusalem. Isn't that 3 days? Mm-hmm. How long were these witnesses in Jericho? 3 days. Or in that area, in Canaan. We see the kingdom established this time. No delay. It comes in. We see judgment executed. Jericho's walls fall down. And then there's one more here that, now you don't find this next one in Scripture. This is found in Talmud and in Jewish tradition. This is what they say. You can take it or leave it. They said Rahab became Joshua's bride. He married her. It's too good not to be true, isn't it? Yeah. Now that's what tradition says. And so if you talk to an Orthodox Jew, this is what they're going to believe. Now if you look through the family tree of Yeshua in Matthew chapter 1, it doesn't quite pan out. But then again, sometimes people had different names. And so, though a different name is used in the family tree in Matthew chapter 1, it still could be that she became Joshua's bride. Became the mother of Boaz. Boaz, in him is strength. He became the husband of Ruth. You know, he reads Goel, the kinsman redeemer who redeemed this Moabitess. Another one who was not allowed to come into the people of Israel, but she did. And she became the grandmother, I was confused, grandmother or great-grandmother, grandmother of David. And someone had a hand up over here. Phil?
Much time, 7 times? Seven times,
yes.
7 days, so is that really close to...
Well, Revelation's full of sevens, isn't it? Yes. So we see trumpets blown and the whole works, yeah. Yeah. Like I said, man could not write a book like this. I want us to look at Rahab's confession there. What she said about God was pretty profound. And so if you go back to chapter 2, while I look for my overhead, there it is. There are several confessions made by people of God. And the sages point out some of these. In Exodus 18:11, Moses' father-in-law, after he witnesses Israel, they've come out of Egypt, and there they are. You know, Moses left with Aaron, and when Moses comes back, he's got a couple million people with him. And when he hears the story of all that God did in Egypt, this is what Jethro says. Exodus 18:11, he says, "Now I know that the Lord is greater than all gods." Right? That's Jethro's confession. Another Gentile, Naaman. And you know the story of Naaman, the leper? We studied him in one of our half-four portions not long ago. And he was told to go dunk himself in the Jordan River 7 times. His leprosy would go, and sure enough, he did, and it went. And after that, he comes to Elisha, and he says, "Behold, I know that there is no other God on all the earth besides Israel's." This is a greater confession than Jethro's, isn't it? Jethro had heard about something, but Naaman had actually experienced the hand of God. Jethro says, "I know that the Lord is greater than all gods, but there are other gods." You see? But what does Naaman say? "Behold, I know there is no other God." There is no other God on all the earth besides Israel's. But Rahab... Women always have greater faith than men. Isn't that true? They just do. Women have more powerful spiritual equipment. Men may have bigger muscles, but women have something that's a lot more important than muscles. Now, a woman says that, not a man. Okay, you take that up with Marie. I didn't say that. And I didn't prompt you to say that, did I, Marie? I'm just avowing any connection. Rahab says, for the Lord your God is God in the heavens above and on the earth below. So her God's even bigger than Naaman's, God of heaven and earth. But then Moses tops them all. In Deuteronomy 4:39, the Lord is God in the heavens above and on the earth below. That's what Rahab said, but he adds one more phrase. There is nothing else. I love whenever I go over this and meditate on these confessions, and I think about the lives here. And one of my observations is, as you go down the line, you see greater suffering. Naaman suffered more than Jethro. We don't see any suffering on Jethro's behalf. But Rahab, I believe, suffered more than Naaman. Naaman was a ruler, a mighty man, rich, famous, good-looking, I'm assuming. And he had leprosy for a time, but it was taken away. Rahab was a harlot. She was used by everybody. And the more she had suffered, when she encountered Israel's God and heard about him, her faith was deeper. But Moses had suffered more than the law, and he is older than all of them. Moses is 120 years old, 160 years old when he said this. And 120. He died 120. He was 120 years old when he said this. And he had suffered great things. He had been a ruler greater than Naaman, a ruler in Egypt for 40 years, and then lost it all. And then he was in the wilderness for 40 years with Jethro, thinking, I was to be the deliverer. I killed one Egyptian and then ran for my life. What kind of deliverance is that? My people are still there in slavery. Think of for 40 years in the wilderness, how much have beaten himself up on what a failure he was. You've heard me share before, somebody said, for 40 years, Moses learned he was a somebody. Then for 40 years, he learned that he was a nobody. And then for 40 years, he learned what God could do with a nobody. And during those last 40 years, he realized, okay, God did make me a deliverer. But his suffering didn't stop. He suffered now for his people, for their faithlessness, for their disobedience, their complaints, their murmuring. And then even himself, he made mistakes. He strikes the rock instead of speaking to it. He's not allowed to go into this land that he's been looking forward to for all this time. So I believe Moses suffered most of all. But look at his insight into who God is. Beside him, there's nothing else. There is nothing else. In him, we live and move and have our being, I guess is what Moses began to realize. There's nothing besides him. I want to take a couple minutes and bring out one thing. You know, most of everything I've shared today comes from our studies in Joshua a few years ago. I basically just went back and listened to the tape on chapter 2. I almost decided to play it for you so I could go back and take a nap or something, but Robin frowned on that idea. But there's something I want to share with you that didn't jump out to me until this week. The scarlet cord. In the tape, we went back and looked where the scarlet cord is found the first time. Remember when the story of Tamar and Judah, and Tamar became pregnant? And Tamar was a righteous woman who masqueraded as a harlot. If you remember the story, it's in Genesis chapter 38. She becomes pregnant. She has twins. But what she wasn't a harlot. She was actually fulfilling Torah. And she had twins, and the first son reached his hand. This is a weird birth. He reaches his hand out of the womb. They tie a scarlet cord around his wrist. And then he brings his hand back into the womb. His brother is born, and then Zerah comes out. That's the one's name with the scarlet cord. Now he's fully born. What's this a picture of? Well, it's a picture of getting a Messiah. Messiah comes into the world temporarily. He sheds his blood, the scarlet cord. and then he's withdrawn from the world. Perez, which means breach, comes, and there's a breach in the time of the kingdom, right? And then Zerah, which means brightness, Zerah comes forth. Here I am, red cords around my hand, now I'm here to stay. Not going back in the womb again. What a powerful picture that is. And so here we see a woman who masqueraded as a harlot giving birth to one who would be an ancestor of Messiah. But in Rahab, we see a woman who actually is a harlot putting the scarlet cord in her window. It becomes a sign of salvation, a sign of covenant with the God of Israel. Now, in our Torah portion in Numbers, go back to our Torah portion for a moment. It's in chapter 15 of Numbers. And I never put these two together previously, but this week, it just like stared me in the face. In Numbers chapter 15, this is right after the failure of the spies and that generation who entered the land. But God continues to give commandments through Moses. And it's interesting that in this chapter, God emphasizes how much Jew and Gentile are one. If you go to verse 14, he says, if an alien, a Gentile, sojourns with you, or one who may be among you throughout your generations, and he wishes to make an offering by fire as a soothing aroma to the Lord, just as you do, so shall he do. As for the assembly, there shall be one statute for you and for the Gentile who sojourns with you, a perpetual statute throughout your generations. As you are, so shall the Gentile be before the Lord. There is one Torah, one law, and one ordinance for you and for the alien, the Gentile who sojourns with you. You go down further in the chapter, verse 29. You shall have one law for him who does anything unintentionally, and for him who is native among you, the sons of Israel, and for the alien who sojourns among you. And it keeps stressing this throughout the chapter. And then we come to verse 32. Now while the sons of Israel were in the wilderness, they found a man gathering wood on the Sabbath day. Those who found him gathering wood brought him to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregation. They put him in custody because it had not been declared what should be done to him. He had obviously violated the commandment. Then the Lord said to Moses, the man shall surely be put to death. All the congregation shall stone him with stones outside the camp. So all the congregation brought him outside the camp and stoned him to death with stones, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. Now, look what it says next. Now remember, this is from this week's Torah portion, which is matched up with our half-Torah portion from Joshua 2. The Lord also spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and tell them that they shall make for themselves tassels, or tzitzit, on the corners of their garments throughout their generations, and that they shall put on the tassel of each corner a cord of tekelis, a cord of blue. Now, in Joshua, we see Rahab putting a cord of red in her window. But here, the Jews are commanded to put a cord of blue on the tassels on the four corners of their garment. Why? It shall be a tassel for you to look at and remember all the commandments of the Lord, so as to do them and not follow after your own heart and your own eyes, after which you played the what? The harlot. Excuse me. A blue cord in Numbers 15, a red cord in Joshua 2. Both used by harlots, one physical, one spiritual. What's God teaching us here? This is what I think the message is. The red cord is for entrance into the kingdom. The blue cord is for prevention, for maintenance of that place in the kingdom. It is by the red cord that Rahab and her house will be saved. Whoever's in that room of hers with the red cord, they were spared from death. The blue cord is to prevent sin. It's to prevent straying after your eyes and your heart, to prevent being a harlot. The red is for salvation. The blue is for prevention. How does that work? Red is always a picture of blood. And here is the blood of the sacrificed lamb, Messiah. That's how we enter into the kingdom. The blue sky. As saved people, we must never forget the red cord, the blood of Yeshua, which brought us into the kingdom. But as people who are saved, we must always focus on the blue. We must always focus on the blue and not stray after our hearts and our eyes. You know, as you go through the description of the tabernacle, what three colors do you find over and over and over and over again? Three colors. Red, blue, and purple. What's purple made of? Red and blue mixed together. Red, blue, and purple. The priest's garments, red, blue, and purple. The canopies in the tabernacle, red, blue, and purple embroidery. Everything inside you, red, blue, and purple. And here, I think, is where we find what the red and the blue are. Red is entrance into the kingdom. Blue is security there. Because we are to focus on the blue so that we do not stray after our hearts and eyes. You understand? The red could be put in the window for Yeshua to see, Joshua. The blue is put on our clothing for us to see. You follow? I want to bring up one more thing and then we'll go to Dale here. When I was looking in Joshua, when it said to put the line of red thread, the cord of red thread, and we're going to close here quickly. In the Hebrew, the language is kind of interesting. It's a little different because it seems a little repetitive. It's called Tikvat Kut Hashani. Tikvat is the word for thread, or for a line. Kut is another word for thread. Shani means red. Tikvat Kut Shani, a line of red thread, or a line of thread that is red. Now that word tikvat, what does tikvat mean? It means hope. Only here, two times, here in Joshua 2:18, I think another time down in verse 20 or somewhere, is it translated line or thread. But it means hope. In other words, you could translate this, put the hope of the red thread in your window. It's your tikvat. There's a fellowship up in Cleveland called Tikvat Yisrael, Hope of Israel, a Messianic fellowship. But this week I looked at that word kut. Went back to find the first place it's used, because that's always where we get to the root of things. The first place it's used is when Abraham has won the battle of the Valley of the Kings. He's rescued Lot and his family and servants and so on. And the kings want to reward Abraham for rescuing them. And what did Abraham say? I will not take so much as a coot of a sandal from you. A sandal shoestring. That's the first place the word is used. He says, I will not take so much as a coot from you so that you cannot say, we made Abraham rich. Now, when I keep that in mind, I think of the word coot. The first place it's used, Abraham says, I won't even take a coot. Not even a shoestring. So that you can't say, you made me rich. Then I'm told I'm to put a thread of blue and have it always something to remember God's commandments by. It's to remember that God makes me rich instead. I take the coot from God, not from the world. The thread comes from God. You see, this man who got stoned, he was working on the Sabbath. Why? Afraid he might fall behind in his finances, maybe? Wouldn't get his work accomplished? 6 days isn't enough to do what I need to do. I need to work on the seventh as well. And so many times we're tempted to violate Shabbat because we think our financial security depends upon it. And we don't have the heart of Abraham who says, I won't take even so much as a shoe latchet because I don't want anybody saying, you made me rich. Instead, we put the cord of blue. We look at it. That's the one we're going to look at. God makes me rich. We have to realize our security does not come from our jobs. Our security comes from God. When we start looking to our jobs for security, our Father in heaven, as a good father, can pull that rug right out from under our feet, can he? It's so easy to do. And whatever it is, however it is you're violating Shabbat because you think you need to, it's just necessary. Don't do that. You trust God. You protect the Shabbat. It will protect you. Okay? Well, there's more we can look into. There always is. But Dale, do you still remember what you were going to say? Okay. Oh, no, this Dale. This, yeah, young. We'll go with young Dale, then we'll go with the less young Dale.
I was wondering if there's any correlation to the sacrifice of the two birds where one was tied to the red cross.
Absolutely.
It's like going to the sky.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, there is. I'll just accept that as a yes or no question. Yes, there is. That's a Beit Midrash discussion there. Yes, absolutely. Not so young Dale. Dale Senior.
Yeah, I wanted to back up a step. When God made Abraham, you know, there's a lot of discussion about, you know, whether Gentiles are made Jews. And I think we get caught up in that a lot. But there is a lot to think about. And when Rahab was sort of saved, when she accepted the God of Abraham, I was thinking back to ourselves, when God made Abraham a Jew, he made him a Jew spiritually before he did anything physically to him. And when Abraham did make it, according to God's prescription, make an outside sign, it was still a hidden sign of circumcision.
Yes.
And then he comes to Rahab, and he, in today's lesson, we see him take Rahab, and according to the Talmud, she actually became another people right there.
Yes.
And when she was saved and believed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's awesome. Because
it is.
That gives me so much of a release where I don't have to worry about the prejudices and things of today which we deal about. And I clearly know the prejudices came up from my parents.
Sure.
Growing up in the neighborhood I grew up in, whatever, and I had to spend a lifetime breaking things down.
Yes.
And when we started talking about Judas versus, it's almost a battle, Jews versus them.
Right.
And who's more saved, and who's got more favorite people, and who's favored.
Yeah.
It's
silly, isn't it?
Going
yes.
On, and it's so much better to look at it in God's light and say, I'm changing you spiritually first. The physical will come later. But right now, grafting it in, you've got the source, and that's what's important.
Yes, that's right. No, God doesn't save good enough. He saves the uttermost, doesn't he? He does a thorough job of saving us, grafting us in, and making us everything we could ever hope to be. Okay, we've come to the end of our lesson. Joshua chapter 3, verse 7. This is a picture. This is the last verse we're going to read. This is a picture of Messiah when he returns. First time, he didn't gain wide acceptance among his people, but when he returns, he will. And in Joshua 3, 7, the Lord said to Joshua, this day I will begin to exalt you in the eyes of all Israel, that they may know that just as I was with Moses, so will I be with you. That's the generation of Israel who are going to behold their Messiah and embrace him with full and open hearts. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that a wonderful truth? Let's close in prayer. Father, thank you for this special word from you. Thank you for how reliable your scriptures are. Lord, I pray we would invest our time wisely in studying them, reading them, meditating upon them, and obeying them. And Lord, based on the things we've learned today and seen, help us to walk more as Messiah walked, for he was aware of all of this. So help us to be more like him. Help us to see him more clearly as we seek your face and accomplish your work in us. We ask in Yeshua's name. Amen.